This episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you by NowSite Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. Bring all your digital marketing to a new level with their simple three-click method. And by Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet, the secure high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
Let me back up. Going back to when I was in college,
okay.
I was on the radio and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be neat to have an opportunity to have been at the start of radio or in television? Of course, radio back in the 1920s, television in the 1950s, but those days were well past by the time I got started.
A little bit.
Yeah. Then in the mid 90s, this thing called the internet came along.
Right.
And, you know, those of us who were around then may remember things like AOL dial up.
Yeah.
Where you would
make that noise dial modem, remember?
Yep. And it was so slow, but
oh my God.
It was amazing to have the opportunity to connect with these folks.
You know, there are still people in the Midwest that don't have the kind of high-speed internet access that we do that are still using dial-up modems. I don't know where they buy them, but I met a guy who sells dial-up internet. He's got dial-up internet companies in the Midwest. I said, how could you possibly do that? Well, they don't have Fios and high-speed cable and stuff like that. Could you imagine loading today's websites on a dial-up modem? Take a day.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work.
No. I remember you used to find photographs online and they would go one line at a time across the screen. You'd be waiting like 40 minutes. Now you couldn't even load that stuff. So it's interesting. Yeah. So I'm sorry. So go back to AOL. We used to get those discs on our
right. Front yeah. Board. The free discs that came everywhere in the mail and every magazine.
Right.
You name it. Well, the opportunity presented itself. I thought, well, how can I use this as a new medium and be in on the ground floor of that? So in 1998, I started a transportation communications newsletter. First, it was a discussion group online, which were used back then. And then I started sharing stories, and it evolved within a couple of years to being a newsletter that came out Monday through Friday, where I would collect stories from a variety of sources.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work. And they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
Hi, my name is Bernie Wagenblast, and I have my own business. I've had one now for about 10 years or so, mainly involved with transportation communications. You may know my name if you're in the New York area, perhaps from being on the radio. I've been a traffic reporter for a number of years on New York area radio stations, and you may have heard my voice, even if you're not from the New York area, just when visiting. I'm one of the voices on the New York City subway, as well as the voice on the air train at Newark Liberty International Airport, and I do a few different things. I do some transportation newsletters. I do some voiceover work, a couple of podcasts, so a little bit to keep me busy, I think, but that's in general, a thumbnail sketch of who Bernie Wagenblast is.
All right. So, Bernie, I can't thank you enough for squeezing me into your what I'm sure is a busy day with all the transportation stuff that you're doing. So I appreciate the intro. And we've known each other for a while now, right? Probably.
Probably going back maybe 10 years or so.
Through the chamber, right? Mm-hmm. And I did recognize your voice before I met you because I used to listen to 1010 Winds. I'm still more of a talk radio person, news So, you know, so I'd listened to you all the years, and then we met through the chamber. So I thought it would be a great opportunity for us to talk about, you know, the business that you're in, which is really like, you know, radio and talking and audio content, really, right?
Yeah, I even make it a little broader than that, communications, because of the Perfect. Newsletters that I do. So it's a combination of audio and online newsletters.
So let's go back to, you know, where you grew up, how you got, and how you got interested in, you know, being on the radio or on the mic. It's not always radio, I guess, nowadays, right?
Like not to not that. Today, but yeah, but no. Back in the day,
it was just radio, right?
Well, there was television, but that wasn't really much of my interest. I started with the idea of going into radio probably about fifth grade. I grew up in Cranford, New Jersey.
Okay.
And I remember when I was a kid, I would take the Star Ledger, the local daily newspaper, and just read it out loud to practice my voice and to get it to the point where hopefully I could one day use it on the radio. And I think initially I was thinking of maybe being a disc jockey, but then that became more of a newscaster. I became more interested in information. So I was lucky enough to actually live that childhood dream.
So that was like late elementary into middle school. You're already interested in broadcasting, really.
Yeah. I knew from fifth grade on that was what I wanted to do. I spent a lot of time at the library reading books about broadcasting, open up the encyclopedia, look up articles about radio, listened to radio for hours and hours. And again, back in the day, it was mainly AM radio. The station I listened to the most was WNEW-AM, 1130. It was sort of what they call a middle-of-the-road station. So they would play things by the Carpenters and the Fifth Dimension, but they'd also have standards by folks like Frank Sinatra and such. But the disc jockeys, they became friends as you listen to them on the radio.
Right. So what do you remember your first, you know, foray into not just studying it, but like being on the mic or doing news, or was it high school or was it after college? Or
it was junior high in 10th grade. Our school system at the time had junior high between 7th and 10th grade, and the sophomores could do something called the Announcers Club, which meant in the morning and the afternoon, you would go down to the principal's office and read the morning announcements, everything from the Pledge of Allegiance to when the chess club was meeting and when the football team would be playing. So that was my first time having an audience, if you will. And it was kind of like radio. And one of the fun things was last year.
System, right?
Yeah, the PA system in all the classrooms. You became a little bit of a personality within the school because all the students and the teachers had to listen to you.
Right.
Last year, I went back to my old junior high, which is now just a regular school, no longer a junior high, and did the morning announcements once again just to relive that moment from many years ago.
So you did that every day, morning announcements, starting in 10th grade?
They had had groups. So one group would do it for a week and then another group would do it for a week. I forget how frequently we would be on, but probably every 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay. And the high school was only 11th and 12th grade?
At the time.
Wow. Because when I was there, I think junior high was 7th, 8th, and 9th. Because now it's like a middle school, right? So it's 6th, 7th, and 8th. And then 9th through 12th is the high school. So I was 7th, 8th, and 9th. And then the high school in those days was 10th, 11th, and 12th. So they must have slowly started moving grades up, I guess.
Well, in my high school, they also had to expand the building because there wasn't enough room for all of those students to be in the building. So that was what happened my senior year of high school. They opened up a new addition, and then they brought up the sophomores to the high school.
Yeah, and I think over time, populations went down, and enrollments went down, and the schools contracted. But now we have the opposite problem where classes are getting very big and, you know, things like that. I don't know what's going to happen now with everything that's going on, but I remember when my kids were in middle school, they couldn't even fit the band on the stage. There's so many kids. And they had to put them in the audience. And, you know, it was craziness. So, okay. So that's when you got started with your voice. So where did you go to college? Where did you study?
I studied at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. And the reason I went there was they had a great radio station. So radio is one of those things that you can study it in a book, but you really have to do it to perfect the art.
Right.
And that gave me an opportunity to be on the air, to do newscasts, to do interviews, to be a DJ, even though that wasn't my goal. I did some occasional music shows.
Yeah, it was part of the job, right?
Yeah, at the experience of being behind the mic, you know, from that first time when you're scared to death and you're afraid of making a mistake to by hopefully by the time you graduate, being a little more confident.
Yeah, that's, I think that's one of the hardest parts of doing the podcast and being interviewers, because you get some people that come on and they're nervous and they're not used to, I guess, hearing themselves. They don't always hear them. Well, I guess they hear themselves through the computer because they don't always have headsets like you and I do. But I'm editing a lot of ums out of the recording, which takes a lot of time on an hour interview.
Oh, yeah.
Hours and hours and hours. You're stopping and going. But I find that it's funny during this whole pandemic thing, people are on Zoom so much, they're getting used to talking more naturally. It's all about, it's all about comfort and nervousness. So if you're not nervous, your mind flows like you're having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're nervous there. And then you get a lot of that kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, you know, so I fixed that later on. But it's always a pleasure to, I knew this would be a good time to talk. We wouldn't get any ums on the radio. Okay, so you went to Seton Hall. And is the radio station still active there now?
Yes, it's WSOU. When I was there, it was a bit more of an eclectic format. So depending on what time of day you tuned in, you would hear different types of music, usually rock, but different forms of rock. Now, going back way to 1986, they said the students, and it was a student-run and still is a student-run radio station, decided that they wanted to make it more like a real radio station and have the same format all the time. And they looked for where was there an opening in New York radio, and that happened to be heavy metal. So they have been doing that format since 1986.
So it's more specialized focus.
Yes. Yeah. Not the hodgepodge that we had when I was a student.
Right. Well, they're looking to expand their listenership, I guess. How far can you be and still get the radio station? I mean, are they on satellite now? You can get it anywhere?
Well, they're on online, certainly, so you can get it anywhere. They're not on the satellite, per se, but with an app and your phone, you can listen to it anywhere in the world.
Most of their listeners are the students, I would think, in the area, right?
Well, that age group, but they get quite a few listeners from outside the university because, again, that type of music is not played anywhere on the radio.
Right.
And they are interviewing a lot of the stars of the different bands that play that type of music, and they have concerts that they promote. So they have very many listeners from throughout the New York metro area. And also, that was one of the nice things about working at WSOU was that it gave you the opportunity to be on the air in New York City, which, as many people know, is the number one market in the country, the most potential listeners of any market in the United States.
Yeah, good exposure. I would think that heavy metal nowadays probably makes heavy metal we grew up with look like easy listening, right? All everything progresses, because I know it's some crazy stuff out there, depending on what you're interested in. Okay, so you went to Seton Hall, and then do you remember what your first job was? Of course you do.
Yeah, my first job was at a station in Elizabeth, New Jersey, WJDM, and I was a stringer, which meant that I would cover Board of Education meetings, city council meetings, things like that in the evening. The station was what they call a daytimer, which under the FCC rules, they were only allowed to be on the air between sunrise and sunset, so they didn't interfere with another radio station that was on the same frequency. So in the winter, they were off at 4:30 in the afternoon. Summertime, you could be on till 9 o'clock at night because the sunset was so much later, but was going out and covering those meetings. And then a little bit later on, I got promoted to being an anchor person and doing newscasts on weekends, as well as at night, I'm trying to think when I would do it. I would do it on the weekends primarily, but also during the summer, full time, doing it in the afternoons.
And those were live, current news. The other stuff you're reporting, you're like taking notes, and then you have to give a report. You weren't live from the courthouse.
No,
No.
We were doing recorded reports, and you would interview the various politicians, and then you'd have to insert that into the phone into the reports. So those were all recorded, but when you're anchoring, those are live. And that's part of the fun of radio, is that it is a bit of a tightrope. You're making a mistake and everyone's hearing you make that mistake. So you really have to guard against making mistakes when you're doing something live.
Right. And then you have somebody in your ear telling you things because you're you must be going to different things while you're doing the report, right?
Well, that station wasn't quite that sophisticated. Okay. It was a small station, so yeah. Pretty much you were doing...
You were doing, yeah. Okay, it's going to start. Good luck, Bernie. We'll see you in an hour. So is that station's not in business anymore, is it?
Actually, they just lost their license earlier this year. They haven't been a local radio station, though, for decades.
Okay.
But they have just signed off as of January.
How do you lose your license? Like what bad things do you do to get your license taken away? Or just out of money, you don't renew anything?
They turned off the transmitter, and if you turn off the transmitter and aren't on the air for a certain period of time, the FCC revokes the license.
Right, because they want to sell the frequency and let someone else use it, right?
Yeah, they don't really sell it, but they could make it available. My guess is in this day and age, no one is going to be licensing that frequency for a radio station. It's an AM station with low power. There's so many other ways you can get information. It's probably not a financially viable way to make money anymore.
Yeah. So is AM radio kind of going the wayside because of all, you know, it seems like AM has also an FM. Like, I think I don't know if it's 1010 Winds or one of them is broadcasts on FM and AM. That I listen to, I think.
Well, you're probably thinking WFAN, which is the sports station. They are on AM and FM, but even the news stations like 1010 Winds and WCBS have an FM side, if you will. It's something called HD, which usually is in car radios, not in home radios.
Right.
But it allows them to have a much clearer signal. But some of the big stations like Winds and WCBS still have listeners, I think.
Yeah.
They're struggle is with trying to attract younger listeners to what they're doing.
Right.
Because young people don't listen to AM radio. So it's an aging demographic that they have.
Definitely. Well, I think it's going to be different moving forward because you have these other platforms, like you mentioned, like the internet or XM radio, satellite radio and all those types of things. So it's, and the FM is a clearer signal. It seems maybe it's not as, you don't get it as far than AM, but yeah, it's just seems like I don't listen to the fan sounds different on AM than it does on FM.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's much clearer.
It's a richer signal. Yeah. It's a richer.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. FM is much better quality audio than it is on AM.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, you take me through your career, so you know better than I do.
Okay. Well, I was still a student when I was working at the radio station in Elizabeth, but my first full-time job came at a New York radio station, WHN, which was a country music station at the time. And again, it was an AM station, but AM was still very well listened to at the time. And I worked in the news department. And back in the day, the FCC had tighter rules that they had on radio stations. So almost every radio station, even if it was a music station primarily, had pretty decent news departments. And I was doing a lot of news gathering. I was reporting. I wasn't in the union, so I wasn't on the air, but I would go out and cover stories and ask questions of the governor and the mayor and people on the street and cover fires that were going on in the city. You name it, you might be out there trying to cover one of those stories and report back on it. But again, since I wasn't on the air, what I would do is just take the audio and then cut that up so that the newscaster could use that on their newscasts.
Right. So they wouldn't be going to you live. They'd have the footage and then work it in when they wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just audio. And sometimes you would do the interviews over the telephone, which if it was a breaking story and you weren't able to get out right away to where they are, it was an easier way to get the newsmaker. But you pretty much had access to anybody and everybody who was a newsmaker in and around New York City back then.
Weren't you telling me when we talked the other day that they used to use the telephones and unscrew the mic on the phone to get a better quality signal? I think that's fascinating, because that's the way you had to do it.
Well, what that was if you were reporting from the field. So later on in my career, I was working on the air on 1010 Winds and doing some stringing for them because I had another full-time job, but I would cover stories. And then when you would do the story from the field, you would have your cassette recorder and a microphone into the cassette recorder. And in the earphone jack was a plug that would come out to two alligator clips. And on old telephones back in the day, you could unscrew the mouthpiece on the telephone and attach these alligator clips, and it would allow you to talk over the microphone, which is a better quality microphone than the one that's in the handset of the telephone. And you could also feed the audio from your tape recording. So, you know, if I was at a fire, let's say, we talked to the fire chief, and this is what the fire chief had to say. You hit play, and then his audio would come up, and it would sound great. It was going directly from the recorder into the telephone, so there was no background noise. You didn't have to worry about anything like that.
Right, because there was no other way to transmit both your voice and that audio back to the station, right?
Yeah, internet didn't exist. There was no satellite, right? There were no cell phones. If you were maybe a little higher up the chain, perhaps you would have a two-way radio that you could use. But since I was a stringer, I wasn't privy to getting that kind of equipment.
Dish on your roof. There was no satellite. No. Yeah, not in those days.
No. It was, for the most part, if you were feeding from the field, it was either on a two-way radio or more, this would be more television, microwave, which they still use, and feeding the signal from a truck to, say, the signal being on the Empire State Building, and then from the Empire State Building to the TV station.
Yeah, the top of the Empire State Building is a big antenna, right?
Yes, yeah. Most of the FM stations and most of the TV stations in the New York area have their transmitters up there.
Right, and there was also a big antenna on top of the World Trade Center, right? And that caused some disruption when they fell, didn't it?
Yeah, 9/11, most of the FM stations went off the air because they did not have a backup transmitter. A few stayed on the air, but most of them went off the air and had to quickly build some sort of a backup to get back on the radio.
Is there an antenna on the Freedom Tower now?
Yes. Yes, there is.
So there's the two that are being used in the area. I'm assuming they all have backup systems now. You all learn the hard way. That's what happened.
Right.
We all have backup systems now. We have cloud systems and backup stuff because we were all, you know, decimated when storms happened and whatever it was. Yeah. I mean, even now it's crazy. Everybody like moved home and you had to move all your equipment home.
And most TV stations, people aren't watching it over the air anymore. They're watching it via cable. So even on 9/11, most people were on cable. So it did not disrupt the viewership for the most part of most of the TV stations because that went on uninterrupted. But if you were watching it over the air, you lost it.
You know, it's funny to see all the reporters working from home in their kitchen or whatever. And then they got a light behind them. They don't realize, or the cat walks by, and then some of them, I guess, eventually put up screens or something behind themselves to make it more viewable, I guess. You know, they would be communicating, hey, don't move that light behind your head. It's shining into all the viewers' eyes. But you get a lot of that stuff. So, okay. So things have really changed a lot in terms of your business. Where do you kind of see things going nowadays in terms of radio? Like, for example, podcasting obviously has supplanted a lot. It's not live. Well, I guess there are some live podcasts, right?
Yeah, a few.
Yeah.
But the majority are recorded.
That's a huge growing area of audio, of listening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your transportation radio or podcasts, aren't they?
Yes.
They live? No, they're podcasts.
No, they're podcasts. Those are all recorded.
Okay. So you give me your opinion about where you think everything's going, and then we'll talk about how maybe somebody could get into this business if they're interested.
Well, let me first talk about radio. I think radio still could have a future because it can do things that you can't do in podcasting. I think there's a connection that you have with a live person that you don't have with a recorded voice.
Right.
And you listen to somebody every day at the same time, they do become a little bit like a family. They hopefully, if let's say it's a music station, they have some insights into the music that you may not have as a casual listener. So things like that. But sometimes I think radio companies are shooting themselves in the foot by doing more and more things remotely. So they have something called voice tracking, for example, where a guy can be in San Diego and he's just recording the intros and the outros for the songs and maybe doing some live, quote unquote, live commercials.
Right.
And that's feeding radio stations across the country with it. So you don't have that local connection. I think one of the things I used to like about the radio is the person who was on the air was experiencing the same weather that I was when I looked out my door. If it was a rainy day, they could reflect that in what they were doing. If it was stormy, that was going on, or snowing, all those things related. But if you're doing a national show, it may be snowing in New England, but 90 degrees in Arizona, so the weather suddenly doesn't become very germane to the conversation. Same thing with satellite radio,
right?
That you don't have that local connection where they can be talking about, oh, the county fair that's going on next week and things of that sort.
So is it a lot of outsourcing that's going on? Is that the problem? Like, they're outsourcing, the weather's a good example, right? So you could be anywhere in the country. If you have equipment, you could tell them what the weather's going to be like in New Jersey if you're in San Diego, right?
Yeah, things like the weather and the traffic are usually outsourced from other companies that do that as a service for the radio stations. With the DJs, it's not so much outsourced. It's people that still work for the same company, but these companies own hundreds, if not thousands, of radio stations. So in a way to consolidate and save money, they use one person to serve multiple radio stations. So
like
usually
syndicating their own show. Basically,
yeah.
In their own network.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the people aren't necessarily here, the DJs, they're not local necessarily.
It's more true in smaller cities. New York being the biggest still tends to have a lot of live on air people. But if you're listening, even in smaller cities like Philadelphia or St. Louis, you will find more and more of the content is coming from another city and it's not from the local station. And then you also have syndicated shows, say like a Rush Limbaugh.
Right, of course.
Or Howard Stern used to be, that they were on multiple radio stations, but doing it from just one radio station.
Yeah, well, Howard Stern's now on satellite, right? So if you're a satellite subscriber, it doesn't matter where you are. Right?
Exactly.
It's close to the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he doesn't need to be syndicated. Yeah. So how does somebody get started in, well, they could start their own podcast, I guess, but I'm not looking to start a career in broadcasting, so I'm looking to promote my legal practice and meet some interesting people, and I enjoy doing it. But if I'm young, right, way back, you and I can remember that. But if I'm young, I'm a teenager in high school, whatever. What would you recommend in terms of getting started? Because it's got to be different than it was when you got started, right?
Oh, definitely.
Path to a career.
I imagine if I were a young person and still had the same interests I had back then, I probably would have started my own podcast. Even if the only people that listen to it are your mom and dad, at least it's experience.
Right. You created content, right, for a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And you learn how to edit. You can learn how to research and do questions.
And now a word from our sponsors. NowSite Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. It's everything you need to market online, and it's totally automated. Build custom websites, optimize them for Google rankings, and automatically create ads and social media posts to drive the most traffic to your sites. Their fully integrated system generates regular email newsletters, manages all your customers and prospects, and provides up-to-date marketing analytics. NowSite. You do your thing, and we'll do the marketing. Use our affiliate link in the show notes to learn more about NowSite and how it can help your business. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000. That's LAW to 21000. Or follow our link in the show notes to learn how you can get this valuable tool for you and your company. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their link in our show notes to learn more and get connected with Fetch. And now back to our show.
One of the most useful things when I was in college was doing interviews with newsmakers. I was able to interview Millicent Fenwick, who a lot of people may remember, the congresswoman.
I remember Millicent.
Yeah, she was, you know, she was even a character, became a basis for a character in Doonesbury.
Did she?
Yes, she was. I forget the character's name, but She was quite the character from Somerset County and had a national reputation. I was very fortunate that...
Is she still around? Because I had met her years ago.
No, she passed away years ago. I don't know exactly when.
Well, I met her when she was still doing reporting locally, but it was just local stuff, writing. She was doing some writing, some, editing, things like that. But I guess, I haven't seen her in years. So I guess she died several years ago.
Yeah. And I even had a chance to go to the White House and ask a question of the President of the United States, which when you're 19 years old is kind of mind blowing.
Yeah. Who was it? Who was the president then?
Gerald Ford at the time.
Oh, okay. It's good you caught him. He was an officer for a period of time. Yeah, but that's all good experience, right? Because it's not, you have to get natural on or comfortable having a mic stuck in your face or hearing your voice. I remember when I got started in podcasting, and I still see this with people that are, you know, not used to doing what you do. You're used to hearing your voice. When you first hear your voice, it's like nails on a chalkboard. I mean, a lot of people are not comfortable. They're not comfortable seeing themselves on video. They're not comfortable hearing their voice. You have to get used to it. I wasn't even used to it. I was like, oh, I sound terrible. But after a while, you get used to hearing yourself and, you know, you adjust things, I guess. But there's a lot of people that come on the podcast that are very nervous. Sometimes I have to talk them into it. I say, this isn't live radio. We can edit it and stop and start. But most people, once they get talking about their life, it's something they're familiar with and they're comfortable with. So if somebody got started, now are there still, do a lot of the high schools have radio stations or radio programs for the kids? Westfield has a TV curriculum and they have equipment. They have a TV studio. I don't know where it goes.
It might be on the local access channel,
like 36.
They could watch that. I would say there are very few high schools I'm aware of that have radio programs. There are even just a handful. I know when I was growing up, Morristown, Piscataway, they had radio stations at the time.
Piscataway was near Rutgers, and Morristown's a bigger town. Yeah,
but college, I think, is where most kids get their first real on-air experience. Some colleges just have very low power stations that maybe can only be heard on campus, whereas other stations serve a wider area. Some college stations are really more professional and there's not as much opportunity for the students to be on the air. They may do things behind the scenes.
Like interns and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. But again, to me, the on-air experience is invaluable. So that would be part of it. But I think, again, the idea of doing a podcast, if someone was interested in being a journalist, I would definitely recommend that. One of the things I tell students is, as soon as you give yourself the title of journalist, there's no test you have to pass to call yourself a journalist or anything like that.
You don't get a license. Right? Yeah.
But you have access to people that you wouldn't have access to otherwise. So it could be a CEO of a company or a political official, folks like that, that would be more anxious to, or more willing perhaps to speak with you than they would be if otherwise.
And meaning you say, I'm a journalist, I'm doing a piece on this topic. And they're like, oh, okay. They don't even ask you like who you work for.
Right.
You're just like, oh, you're a journalist? Because journalists, I guess, do pieces and then they try and sell it to the news or they're employed, like you said, on a consulting basis or a 1099 basis with different places and people tap into whatever it is that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Especially for writers. That's true. Magazine writers, I think many of them work for themselves and you might find their bylines in a lot of different publications.
Right. Well, are they being asked to do pieces on a freelance basis? Or are they writing stuff and then selling it on submission to it?
I've never done that, but I believe most of them are assigned. So they get a reputation, they've done work for an organization, and that organization asks them to cover this story because they think they're well-suited, depending on what the story is. If it's something about real estate, they know, okay, this person is knowledgeable in real estate and we can do a good story with them versus maybe somebody doing a business story and turning to someone else about that.
Right. Like they want to do it on transportation, they would ask you. So how did you transition from what you're doing now off the radio? How did the whole transportation I mean, Transportation Radio, right, is the podcast?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why don't you tell me about that?
Well, that was more along the lines of deciding that, well, let me back up. Going back to when I was in college,
okay.
I was on the radio, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be neat to have an opportunity to have been at the start of radio or in television? Of course, radio back in the 1920s, television in the 1950s, but those days were well past by the time I got started.
A little bit.
Yeah. Then in the mid-90s, this thing called the internet came along.
Right.
And, you know, those of us who were around then may remember things like AOL dial-up.
Yeah.
Where you would
make that noise dial with modem, remember?
Yep. And it was so slow, but
oh my God.
It was amazing to have the opportunity to connect with these folks.
You know, there are still people in the Midwest that don't have the kind of high-speed internet access that we do that are still using dial-up modems. I don't know where they buy them, but I met a guy who sells dial-up internet. He's got dial-up internet companies in the Midwest. I said, how could you possibly do that? Well, they don't have Fios and high-speed cable and stuff like that. Could you imagine loading today's websites on a dial-up modem? Take a day.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work.
No. I remember you used to find photographs online, and they would go one line at a time across the screen. You'd be waiting like 40 minutes. Now, you couldn't even load that stuff. So it's interesting. Yeah, so I'm sorry. So go back to AOL. We used to get those discs on our
right. Front yeah, board. The free discs that came everywhere in the mail and every magazine.
Right.
You name it. Well, the opportunity presented itself. I thought, well, how can I use this as a new medium and be in on the ground floor of that? So in 1998, I started a transportation communications newsletter. First, it was a discussion group online, which were used back then. And then I started sharing stories, and it evolved within a couple of years to being a newsletter that came out Monday through Friday, where I would collect stories from a variety of sources, all dealing with
electronic
transportation.
Newsletter.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That goes out via email. You know, the cost of distribution is nothing.
Right. You don't print costs or mailing costs or anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's timely. You know, Time Magazine, they may have the resources to send it out, but it's still going to be at least a few days old by the time you open it up in your mailbox.
Right.
Whereas something via email can be, I've put in stories minutes before I've sent out the newsletter, so it can be extremely timely.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that was the opportunity for me to be involved with a new medium, and that's what I wanted to do with that.
Yeah, so in 98, where you didn't have your own website, right? It had to be through CompuServe or AOL or Prodigy or where you would have a discussion group, or did they have websites at that point?
They did, but the average person did not have a
website. Yeah, the access wasn't like it is now. You don't go on Wix and start your own website in 10 minutes. Right. Yeah. You use Squarespace, and then you use PayPal, and you could just charge people. It's easy. In those days, it was serious to have a e-commerce site or any of that stuff. All right. So I think it's interesting because, and that's why I wanted you and I to talk about it, because up until I got it. So I used to listen to, I told you, talk radio, and my wife makes fun of me. She's like, you don't listen to music. I just like listening to people talking about, you know, it's more cerebral for me, I guess, to listen to things. And then I guess I discovered podcasting several years ago. Somebody told me about a business, because I listen to a lot of business stuff, a lot of news related stuff. And I think I was listening to a TEDx talk or watching a TEDx talk. And then there was something came across the screen like, you know, you can listen to TEDx on podcasts. And I'm like, oh, pull that up. So I started listening to the TEDx podcast with Guy Raz. He does a lot of the TEDx stuff. And then he had a podcast called How I Built This, which I'm still waiting for more episodes to come out. I don't know if they will or not. But he basically is interviewing all these very famous people. You know, Sarah Blakely. I think he did the last interview with Kate Spade before she killed herself, just by coincidence. Howard Schultz. I mean, and he's done hundreds of people. So I started listening to all his stuff. And then one day there was like there was an ad or something I saw. It must have been on YouTube. It was a video, like how to start a podcast for $75. I'm like, well, for $75, I'll take a risk. You know, I'm not going to do it for $2,000. buy all kinds of equipment. So I got a USB mic and I found, I learned about free software online, which is an education of itself. Like you said, you got to learn how to edit. You got to learn how to, getting these things posted is harder than learning how to edit the thing. So you create these episodes. And then I was like, well, what do you do with them now?
Right.
Right. They don't just magically like appear in the ad stratosphere. Everybody can listen to them. So, I mean, I'm emailing back and forth between iTunes and Google, and they're sending me pictures of things circled. Like I got to put in this feed, and I don't even know how I did it because I followed an article, but it's working now. So let's hope it doesn't stop working, because if it doesn't, I got to go back and learn it again. But I wasn't in the financial position to just hire a company to do all the post-production and the social media. It would be great if I had an assistant. I could just talk to you and then walk away and let them do it. But I don't know if that's a very cost-effective way of doing things, but I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that for kids, I don't know how many young listeners we have, but maybe for parents who have kids who are interested in broadcasting and radio and things like that, that they would take an interest in learning that they could do this stuff for, you know, a few $100, get a Blue Yeti USB thing that plugs into your laptop and start to create content.
Yeah, it's not difficult. The barriers of entry are pretty small.
Very small.
And again, like you say, just plugging in a microphone to your computer.
Yeah.
You can get free software to edit the audio. And even the distribution is not all that expensive. If you're not putting up hours and hours of content every month, you can get it for a relatively low price. And they handle getting it out to places like Apple and Google and Spotify and Pandora and all these other places that air podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. I use Podbean. And I think if you're just an amateur person, for the most part, you can do it almost for free until you really put a lot of content up there. It might limit the show notes and things like that you can do. But for the most part, I think you can start for free.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah, that system helps. It is not guaranteed. It doesn't work perfectly, but it helps you post to the different directories, mm-hmm. the main ones, at least, you know.
Yes.
And there's also a bunch of others out there. But yeah, I think it's definitely, it's an interesting business. I've been meeting very interesting people. I've been connecting with people actually all over the world lately because of the fact that we're all stuck home. People have a lot of time and they're looking for opportunities. And they've been contacting me. I interviewed a woman from Singapore who's a voice coach with not necessarily radio people, but I guess she could coach radio people, but really people that get up and speak to groups and need to be more confident with what they do and things like that. And then a woman from Malaysia reached out to me. She's like a former Miss Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And I haven't gotten her on the podcast yet, but she was going back and forth. There was a guy in Australia I spoke to. There was a guy who was a professional. He does food challenges. He's not like the guy at Coney Island, Joey Chestnut, who eats the hot dogs.
Right.
He doesn't do like, you know, competitive eating. He does food challenges. So if a restaurant wants to do a publicity thing and they had a, I don't know, what's a large burger? What's a burger? Like a 10, 12 ounce burger. So let's say it was a 28 ounce burger, something enormous. He would eat it and do the challenge to raise money, help them. And the funny thing is he doesn't really make a lot of money doing it. He makes a little bit, gets the meal for free, covers his expenses, but he makes money on the content. So they video, they record the content. And I think he has 1 million YouTube subscribers and more than 1 million people on Facebook to follow him. And that's how he gets his advertising and he pays his bills.
Wow.
Through that. Because he wasn't really able to make a lot of money doing the food challenges. And then they realized they were getting a lot of play on the social media platforms. Now he's got a guy who follows him around and, well, he can't follow him around now.
Right.
He's kind of, yeah, landlocked. So he found me and we talked. He's supposed to do like a whole swing in the Southeast in the summertime. And the funny thing is he's studying to be a dietitian now.
Oh.
So he's going to retire and then teach people how not to do this because it's definitely not healthy.
Yeah, those 28 ounce burgers are not the most healthy thing to eat.
Yeah, and overwhelming one sitting. Healthy food, right? Eating that amount of food is not, it's overwhelming for your body. It's, yeah, your body can't digest. I don't think he eats during the week. He like takes 3 days off of eating because he eats so much food. You know, it's craziness. But then I'm trying to think who else. Oh, I met a guy who's a professional miniature golfer.
Oh.
Do you know that you can do that professionally? you have a fallback career.
The inventiveness of people is amazing when you look at it. And I think the internet has brought that out even more than it was before.
Yeah, definitely. And this guy, what he the same thing. So he made a little bit of money playing in tournaments. Obviously, it's not he said there's some tournaments that have as big as a, like a $20,000 purse for, which was high for what I thought it would be. But he started reviewing golf courses. So he has this website. It's called minigolfreviews.com, I think. And he was reviewing. There's courses all over the country. Apparently, Putt-Putt Golf is like a brand name. So they're not all Putt-Putt Golf things, even though we use that interchangeably. So he would travel around and he's reviewing these courses and he got advertising. So he's been monetizing what he's doing. But he wasn't really making a lot of money through the competitions, a little bit. But he, again, found a way to, you know, it's like the radio and the TV side, right? Or magazines. It's all advertising. It's about support. Because people aren't really paying. Well, I guess Sirius they're paying, but not really paying for radio. They're not paying to be on the pod. I'm not getting people to subscribe to my podcast and pay $1 a month. Forget it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't pay a quarter a month, you know?
Well, you know, one of the differences, obviously, if I were an entrepreneur in the pre-internet age, I might be limited to serving a local community or perhaps a state. Now with the internet, the whole world is my potential audience.
Yeah. And you can get followers all over.
Mm-hmm.
So how did Transportation Radio get started? Were you approached by an organization or?
No, again, it was something that I thought, you know, hey, this sounds interesting. At the start, podcasting was kind of difficult to get into. You had to know coding and it was not an easy thing to do.
Wasn't plug and play.
Yeah. And when it became a little bit easier, I said, oh, well, let's try to do that. At the same time, I had also started something for my local community, Cranford, called Cranford Radio. So I really have two different podcasts. But the transportation ones were initially just going out and interviewing different transportation newsmakers. I was somewhat known already in the field because of my newsletters. So that helped.
Right.
And did those interviews and later on went out to organizations and said, hey, would you be interested in having me host a podcast for you? Again, focused on transportation. They know that I have a track record. I could let them listen to episodes that I did for free, but it gave an example of my work. So I had a portfolio.
Right.
And the clients would say, sure, you know, we'll hire you to do that. And it was a great opportunity.
So you're on contract now with organizations like, you know, some like associations or something. You'll tell me who you're working for, but, and you're producing specific content for their organization, or is it your radio and then you're like licensing the content to them?
No, it's specifically for them. So they'll identify the guest that they want interviewed. They'll give me a little bit of background about the guest. But again, since it's usually, it's always transportation related, I have some knowledge already. I'm not starting from scratch.
Right.
And we do the interview, much like you and I are doing the interview now, where we talk and we'll ask the questions and then I produce the post-production and send them the finished product.
So do you, so they find the guests for you. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. And that way, in a lot of cases, they may have particular interests as an association. Perhaps they have publications and they might do this in conjunction with one of their publications. So that's a possibility.
Right.
And it could just be opportunities to promote something within the association that is of particular interest to the members that I might not be aware of.
I see. Okay. So what kind of people are you interviewing? Like in the, what do they do?
Well, let's see. Some of the most recent ones, I did an interview with the head of the American Public Transportation Association a couple of weeks ago. Okay. We were talking about the effects of COVID-19 on public transit. I'm doing an interview the Commissioner of Transportation for the state of Minnesota in a week or so. We're going to be talking about some different issues that they're dealing with there. I talked with a woman who runs a tech project down in Georgia. That Georgia DOT and other agencies are involved with, where they're testing different technologies on highways that hopefully will have an opportunity to be deployed around the country and maybe even around the world. So it can be a host of people. It can be executives. It can be entrepreneurs. It can be much like this show. It can be a variety of people, but they all have some connection to transportation.
Yeah, I would think that it's a timely topic right now, especially public transportation is getting walloped.
Yes.
There's got to be a lot of transit systems that are really going to suffer in this country when their ridership's down 90%, you know,
because
they rely on all of that revenue to pay their people. And I mean, they lay off people, right? So if you know, you have 1,000 trains and they only have, you know, less than 100 going, you don't need the people as much. So you're laying people off. I mean, it's a huge devastation. You don't realize the big part our transportation system plays in our economy.
Sure.
You know?
And what is the effect going to be once we get on the other side of this pandemic? Are people going to say, hey, you know, this working from home worked out pretty well, and managers saying, yeah, I could see that, and maybe we'll only have people come in a couple of days a week as opposed to 5 days a week. So there'll be less demand for transit systems, perhaps.
Right. Plus, they don't want to pack a train car right now. Who wants?
Right.
So they're going to have social distancing there. They'll probably separate rows, only allow a certain amount of people in a car at one time. So, and then you don't have the money, so you can't run more trains to make up for the volume because it costs more money. So I don't know how it's solved. You can't raise the price of the ticket too much.
I think they're all trying to figure out how they're going to do this. It's a challenge because it's a government service for the most part.
Right.
So it can't just, you know, if you have a store and nobody's coming, you close the doors and maybe hopefully wait out the pandemic and reopen when people can come back. But a transit system has to keep running because essential workers, whether they're working in a hospital or a grocery store, depend on transit to get to work.
Right.
And again, you can't just make the trains very small and squeeze everybody in because of the social distancing issues.
Yeah, it's a big problem. I mean, the whole system of a metropolitan area relies on its transit system. Mm-hmm. Subways, buses, trains. I don't know, maybe we'll go back to horse and buggy, but whatever it is to get in and out of places. I mean, maybe they'll be limiting car access to New York City so it won't be so crowded. I mean, New York City, you can't walk down the street without bumping into people every 4 feet, you know?
Except for now.
Social distancing. Right, for now it's easy. But once people, even part-time, when there's, you're talking 8 million people that live in the city. Once people start going to work, social distancing is going to be extremely difficult in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they control that. You know, they give you a number and they say, well, between 9 and 12 on Mondays and Wednesdays, you can go out. Got to be very difficult. I don't know what the governor's doing and what the mayor's doing, how they're going to. That's why they close the school system. They figure, you know, we got enough problems. Let's not leave the kids exposed to this. Let's deal with the adults now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see what happens. Maybe it's being announced now, but I know the governor was getting on TV today and announcing what he wanted to do with the school system. I can't imagine that they're going to reopen.
I don't see it happening for this academic year, New York, they've already decided statewide, but I don't see it happening in New Jersey this academic year.
Yeah, it's too problematic.
And then even the question of what happens in September when schools are scheduled to reopen, do you have to have some sort of social distancing? Because until they get to the point where there's a vaccine or enough people have been exposed and they don't have to worry about transmission from person to person, how do you handle something like that? Brains a lot smarter than mine have to try to come up with answers to that.
I know. They're already talking about that the virus is mutating and, you know, is changing. Look, clearly, if you're going to have social distancing in the schools, you need more time than 2 weeks to figure out how the hell to do this, which is a huge problem. And I don't know. Maybe they'll do, I don't know. What do? You bring some of the kids in on Tuesday, Wednesday, and you bring some of the kids on other days, and you straddle things, and the classes are smaller. But what do you do? Then what do the parents do? Then they don't go to work half the time. I mean, the whole thing's a huge, you know, box, can of worms. And even the I've been very disappointed with, hopefully this will probably get out there now that I'm saying it, but I've been very disappointed with the teaching that's been going on in Westfield, or the lack thereof. I've heard very good things about Cranford, for example, that the teachers are really involved with the students and they're teaching and they're doing whiteboarding. From what I can see with my kids, I got two girls, one going in eighth grade in the middle school, and they seem to be doing a pretty good job, not tremendous. And one in the high school is in 11th grade. She's getting no teaching. Teachers are like, listen, here's the assignment. If you have any questions, let me know. As opposed to actually teaching a class, which is what they're supposed to do. A lot of these teachers have just like, and it's just very disappointing because I think that at a time when these kids are, you know, really getting ready to take the ACTs or, you know, take their AP class, AP tests, and I mean, all that kind of stuff, they're just not, it doesn't seem like they're stepping up to the plate like other communities are. And I have spoken to people, for example, in your town, and I hear that the teachers are really doing active teaching to help the kids while they're home. And I don't see that happening in Westfield. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my impression.
Yeah, here in Cranford, I've had an opportunity to look a little at that because my wife is a teacher. So I've seen some of the teaching that goes on online and the students participating and some of the activities. I can't speak to Westfield, but certainly I know at least at the elementary level here in Cranford, that's taking place because I'm seeing it.
Yeah, the middle school and the elementary school levels, I think, are pretty good also. But it seems like the high school, they just kind of, you know what, they're high school kids, they'll figure it out type of thing. And they can't. Mm-hmm. They're still high school kids.
Mm-hmm.
They got a lot of growing to do. They're at a point where, you know, my 11th grader, she's getting ready to go to her senior year. She's looking at school. She's got to do virtual tours of universities that you can't go visit now. You know, people, she's going to have to take the ACTs online or, you know, it's just very difficult. So I think adding to that by not being an active teacher is not helpful to the kids. They got enough pressure worrying about what the heck they're going to do going forward. You know, it's a new world.
Oh, definitely. And yeah, I suppose if there's one positive thing there is that everybody's in the same boat. It's not as if New Jersey is is the only place where kids aren't going to school, but it's across the country. So
yeah, and then the
universities hopefully will be understanding
accommodations for things. They're going to look at things differently. There's been talk about completely scrapping the standardized test for class of 2021. I don't know. I don't know what they're gonna do, but we'll have to see where it goes. So, any final thoughts, suggestions, beliefs, commentaries, whatever you want to say before we sign off? And I appreciate you spending time with me.
Oh, my pleasure, and thank you for having me. I think one of the things, since this is a podcast for entrepreneurs, I would say one of the things that I've always enjoyed during my career, and I've been fortunate to be involved with several times, is being involved with something that's just starting up. A few times it's been myself, as we talked about the newsletters and the podcast, but other times it's been working for companies. So when traffic reporting was being done by one company in the New York market for the first time, I was one of the on-air reporters. And that was great fun because you had a chance to make up the rules as you went along. You weren't falling into a bureaucracy that already existed. It was an opportunity to write the rules as you went along. I was involved with another government organization that coordinated among all the different transportation agencies in the region. So those opportunities, if they present themselves and you're willing to take a little bit of a risk and not have to have something completely spelled out, I would definitely recommend taking advantage of that. It's a great bit of fun and it's an opportunity to really stand out from the crowd.
Sure. Good advice. Yeah. So if there's any younger people listening out there, it's a good time to kind of explore their options, especially if they're laid off and they don't know what's going on and it's something they're interested in, you know, start a podcast. By the way, you can also become, if there's anything you have an interest in, and you know this, but I'm just saying it on the mic, a hobby or something that you're knowledgeable in, you can go on podcasts. There's a podcast guests website. There's several of them, as a matter of fact, where you can list your skills. You don't have to be a podcaster, and they're all looking for guests to talk. And that's good experience too, to get interviewed about what you do, like we're doing here today.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And I think there are many opportunities, you know, no matter what happens, you have to look for, don't just take advantage of opportunities, but create your own opportunities.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You can create a following through your knowledge of or your interest in whatever it is. And build it up. So Bernie, I thank you. I know you got a lot of things going on every day and putting, you know, squeezing me in. Hopefully we'll see each other soon in person. That
would be
day
nice.
Will come. It's going to happen. And I appreciate it. I'll let you know when this episode's coming out. I'll send you the show.
If you like our podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review. And feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is a production of Mitchell C. Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about Mitchell and his practice, you can find him on social media or visit his website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.